This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
So tonight, we are thrilled to be hosting Ibram Kendi finally for the paperback release of his book, Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America, which just debuted on the New York Times bestseller list for its paperback release. It also won last year's National Book Award for Nonfiction. It was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, and it was named a Best Book of the Year by the Washington Post. Dr. Kendi has contributed pieces to publications like the New York Times, Newsweek, Time Magazine, many, many others. And as of recently, he is now a professor at American University here in Washington, D.C., as well as the founding director of its Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center. Before this, he wrote the book, The Black Campus Movement, and this book also has roots in studying higher education. As mentioned inside, Stamped from the Beginning grew from a project studying the origins of black studies programs in the 1960s, and then morphed into a thorough breakdown of American history, a history where racist ideas have taken root as justification for racist practices, leading this country from the days of slave ships to the days of private prisons. Joining Dr. Kendi in discussion tonight is Wesley Lowery, Washington Post reporter, CNN political commentator, and author of They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. Please join me in welcoming both authors to Politics and Prose.
Standing room only in here. Thank you all for coming out this evening. We're running a few minutes behind because we were finishing the book. You know, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's a little. But it. All jokes aside, though, it's a real honor and privilege to be here tonight to talk about a work that I just think is essential and extremely important. And certainly also so given the moment in which we're having this conversation, where as like clockwork, we find ourselves again having discussions about our history as it relates to race in this nation, about our treatment and these ideas of equality or injustice in the United States of America, specifically as it relates to black lives and the legacies of the attempts previously to devalue those lives. And so I think it's just an excellent time to have this conversation about this work. To start off, I wanted to, you know, I know some folks in the room have read the work, and others probably are interested or have heard, are buying it today. Hopefully you're all buying it today, right? What I thought was fascinating was the structure, and I think it's important not to belabor this, but to walk through some of the kind of premises that set out this book, right? And so the first is your definition of what a racist idea is. Because I think very often when we have these conversations, we enter them sometimes with different ideas and different definitions of what these words mean. What is racist? Who is a racist? What is racism? What is a racist idea? And then beyond that, you kind of lay out three specific types of ideas. Mm-hmm. And so what I'll do real quick is, I mean, I've got the definition in front of me from your work, and then I'll have you expand on it a little bit, just so everyone in the room is kind of starting at the same point. Mm-hmm. The definition of a racist idea, as you lay out towards the beginning of this, is any concept that regards one racial group as inferior or superior to any other racial group in any way, right? This idea that if this idea says that one group is inferior or superior, it is by definition a racist idea. Now specifically, the book also talks about three types of ideas. It talks about anti-racist ideas, segregationist ideas, and assimilationist ideas. Could you walk through just a little bit how you settled on these definitions and what they mean in a practical sense as people begin engaging this work?
Sure. So good evening, everyone. It's truly, truly an honor for me to be here. It's an honor for me to be in conversation with you, Wesley. It's an honor for me to be here at Politics and Prose, and it's an honor for me to be now a resident of D.C. And I see many eagles out there from AU, and so don't worry, I'll represent tonight. And so to your question, of course, when I engaged in writing a history of racist ideas, I quickly realized that pretty much every person in history who expressed a racist idea did not believe that their ideas were racist. Like, I had yet to come across a single person that said, yep, I'm a racist, right? Everyone was defining their ideas outside of racism. And so that meant, first and foremost, that I had to define a racist idea. And, you know, as you stated, any idea that suggests a racial group is superior or inferior to another racial group in any way. But then I realized that there were two types of racist ideas. There was the idea that the racial groups are created unequal, which I sort of named segregationist ideas. And then there was the idea that the racial groups are created equal, but certain racial groups became inferior. Another way to think about this is the segregationist ideas state that let's say black people are inferior by nature, while assimilationist, which I argue is a second type of racist idea, would say that black people are inferior by nurture. And so while segregationists would say that its inferiority is in black people's DNA, we know that there's no such thing as black sort of, there's no such thing as a biological racial group, but they would say they're biological racial groups and certain racial groups are superior. And since it's biological, it's permanent, right? While assimilationists would say, well, no, the racial groups have all been created equal, but black people became inferior as a result of being raised in that pathological culture, whether that pathological culture was African-American culture or barbaric Nigerian culture. Or black people became inferior as a result of the growing up in an environment of enslavement or an environment of segregation or an environment of poverty. In other words, poverty wasn't just reducing the opportunities of black people, it literally made the people into impoverished people. Slavery wasn't just dehumanizing, it literally dehumanized black people. And so when we define a racist idea as any idea suggesting that a racial group is superior or inferior in any way, we begin to see these different types of ideas. Some saying that black people are inferior as a result of biology, others saying they're inferior as a result of culture or environment.
Now, the way this book is structured is it's narrated, and it's a meticulous history, but it's narrated and organized through the tales and stories of five kind of specific people who bring us back really to the, when the first ships are arriving, the first Africans arrive here in North America, and bring us to contemporary day. Going from Cotton Mather, basically, all the way up through Angela Davis and then the election of President Obama. How did you settle on these narrators, on these characters? And for those who haven't read the book, broadly, where did they each fit in this spectrum of, you know, from anti-racist ideas to segregationist ideas?
Sure. And, you know, I didn't define anti-racist ideas. Anti-racist ideas, basically, you believe the racial groups are what? Equal. Right, there's nothing wrong with black people as a group. There's nothing wrong with any other racial group. Right, there's nothing wrong with black women, black men, black poor, and so on and so forth. So the five major characters in the text really serve as sort of tour guides to this larger three-way debate between segregationist, assimilationist, and anti-racist ideas. Typically, these people were at the forefront of these debates. They were at the forefront of racial debates in America. And so the first major character was Cotton Mather. Cotton Mather was a Boston theologian. He really was part of the first intellectual dynasty in colonial America. His grandfather helped found Harvard. His father was a president of Harvard. He was even more illustrious than his father and grandfather, having published more than possibly every other person of his generation combined. Cotton Mather, who lived from roughly 1660s to 1720s, was involved in a debate over whether black people could become Christian. So at the time, racial ideas were largely theological ideas, because theological ideas were largely scientific ideas. And so he made the case that black people could become Christian. They could be civilized. They have the capacity to have white souls. And so he often wrote about this notion of white souls. And black people, though their bodies can be permanently enslaved, their souls can be saved and become white. That was the argument he made to those slaveholders who were like, okay, if we save these people, they're going to have to become free. He was like, no, they don't. You know, their bodies can still be enslaved, right? Their bodies can be enslaved and remain black, but their souls have the capacity to become white. For assimilationist, whiteness has long been the standard, right? And so Thomas Jefferson, who was the second major character, I mean, you write a book on race, you have to talk about Thomas Jefferson, right? Who was the second major character, he was largely involved in the secularization of racist ideas or racial ideas. And I sort of show how he really stood between segregationist and assimilationist ideas. He, to a large extent, really did not want to choose. And so he really couldn't decide whether black people were inferior by nature or by nurture. But he knew, or at least he thought he knew, that black people were inferior. And the third major character was William Lloyd Garrison, who was the most illustrious white male abolitionist, of course, the editor of the Liberator. And William Lloyd Garrison really pioneered the idea that discrimination is making black people into inferior beings. And that's why we need to eliminate that discrimination. And of course, the discrimination of his time was slavery. So slavery is literally making black people into brutes. It's so horrific that it's making these people into barbarians. So we have to, of course, eliminate it. Now, black people, even though they were enslaved, were not brutes. But he, of course, had been led to believe that they were. So I make the case he was an assimilationist. But he believed they had the capacity, if free, to be civilized and developed. W.E.B. Du Bois was the fourth major character. And I argue, for those of you who are familiar with Du Bois' double consciousness, that Du Bois' double consciousness was actually a double consciousness of assimilationist and anti-racist ideas. And I chronicle how over the course of his life, he developed a single consciousness of anti-racist ideas, a single consciousness of anti-racist ideas that the last major character, Angela Davis, carried on to this day.
Now, the premise of, I think, the fundamental premise upon which this study and this book is based on is something similar to what you just said. You write this at the beginning, And I think it's important to note, you know, especially in perhaps in a room like this or in a conversation where we, I think, would both agree on what I'm about to read, it can be something that gets glossed over. But I think it's important because I think it's a statement that is still extremely important in the moment we're in. But you write, you say, the only thing wrong with black people is that we think there is something wrong with black people. Black Americans' history of oppression has made black opportunities, not black people, inferior. Right? And I see that, you know, we talk about, and in the book, you write about these historical constructs, these historical ideas, right? Are black people physically being made inferior because of slavery? If we get them out of slavery, will we be able to basically restore their whiteness, make them whole and human again? But we see this often in conversations. I see this in kind of the contemporary world, in conversations we have about gun violence or conversations we have about so-called black-on-black crime or about poverty. This idea that there must be something wrong, whether it's laziness, whether it's, you know, a lack of fathers or a lack of morality, there must be something wrong with black people, as opposed to something wrong with the opportunities black people are being given. And so I just thought that premise for a book like that is something that is, in fact, a much more radical statement given the world we live in and the way we frame our conversations than I think people necessarily understood, right? How do you think that does relate to the contemporary world we're in? Because like I said, what I thought was fascinating as you trace the history of these ideas is how how they translate to modern times so easily. You watch the arguments being made to justify the creation of this type of transatlantic race-based slavery. You watch the arguments being made to justify, whether it be convict labor or Jim Crow, and you see those same types of arguments showing up in our contemporary conversation. Yeah.
And I think you do, and I think that really we've been engaged since the beginning of this country in a three-way debate about race in America. And we're engaged in a three-way debate right now. And I think the irony is, as you sort of read Stamp from the Beginning, you start to remember things that people are saying sort of right now about particular issues because they're saying the same thing, right? They may be using different terminology, but they're ultimately saying the same thing. I mean, as it relates to race and policing, we were in a three-way debate. Each position had its own slogan, right? You had Blue Lives Matter, you had Black Lives Matter, and you had what? All Lives Matter, each of which had three different positions on what was the problem and what was the solution, right? Of course, the Blue Lives Matter crowd stated that the problem, the fundamental problem, was black people, was black on black crime, was black violence, was black people are waging a war against the cops. There's actually a book entitled The War on Cops, right? And so that was the problem, is what's wrong with black people, right? On the other side of the equation, you had the Black Lives Matter position. The Black Lives Matter position was like, no, there's nothing wrong with black people and everything wrong with the criminal justice system and everything wrong with the way in which these police officers are trained and everything wrong with the racist ideas that they're carrying around in their minds that translate to their guns, right? That was the position of Black Lives Matter. There's nothing wrong with black people, but there's something wrong with the persisting amount of racial racism within the criminal justice system. And then you had the All Lives Matter crowd, which was like, you know what, both of y'all are wrong and both of y'all are the problem, right? It is the case that there is a war on cops and we need to recognize that. It is the case that there is a black on black crime problem. There is the case that these young black males listen to hip hop and just go out and start shooting after they listen to somebody's song. But it's also the case that there's something wrong with the criminal justice system. It's also the case that cops are shooting young black men. And so yes, there is something wrong with black people, but there's also something wrong with the criminal justice system, which historically has been the assimilationist position, right? There's something wrong with society and black people. And so we're seeing this, and this is the same debate we had over slavery. There's something wrong with black people because they have been imbruted by slavery and we just can't free them and allow them to have land and give them security. We actually have to civilize them. Right, that was a position, right, during Reconstruction, while others were like, no, all you need to do, all black people need is land. While others said if they have their own land, they'll ruin it and they'll ruin the nation.
Now, one of the things you talk about, and even through the selection of your characters and the discussion of the characters, is how very often otherwise progressive, both white people and black people, adopt assimilationist positions as a means of appealing to a center or splitting a difference, right? This idea, you get into whether it be Obama's race speech, whether it be the role of organizations like the NAACP or W.B. Du Bois himself, that very often well-intentioned people who we historically look at as being on the right sides of these types of issues, abolitionists and people crusading against lynchings, may in fact themselves be advancing and perpetuating these racist ideas, right? How do we grapple with that when we consider the legacy, whether that be of someone like the President Obama or Du Bois, or, you know, like, how do we grapple with this idea that people who themselves fight against racism, maybe doing so in ways that are perpetuating racist ideas?
Wow.
An easy one.
I think that idea is what the reader is forced to grapple with. As they read Stamp from the Beginning, as they read about some of the assimilationist ideas that David Walker uttered in his appeal to the colored citizens of the world, or Frederick Douglass uttered in some of his speeches, and a few lines later, he would state the most anti-racist sort of things. Some of the things that W.B. Du Bois uttered, and E. Franklin Frazier, and even Barack Obama. And I think what I attempted to do was to write a book on ideas, right? I wasn't at a point in which I was able and willing to define what a racist was. But I was at a point in which I could define what a racist idea was. And what that means is you can have people who can have both racist and anti-racist ideas, depending on the issue, right? You can have black men who would say, you know what, black men are equal to white men, right? You know, in every respect. But then when they turn around and they look at black women, they say, well, yeah, black women are inferior to white women, right? You can have that, right? And I wanted to sort of show the complexity, right, of people by focusing on people's ideas. And I think that's the way I sort of attempted to do that. And I also wanted to sort of be very, very crystal clear as to what a racist versus what an anti-racist idea was. And I also sort of began the book stating that I, too, was born and raised in a world of racist ideas, many of which I had consumed myself. And so I wasn't necessarily like writing down to anyone, right? I was writing to myself because I was part of this same history, because that's how seductive and widespread and powerful these ideas are.
When we have these conversations as a nation, or even in elite spaces and black spaces and white spaces, there very often is a lot of back and forth about who's a racist and what is a racist and what is racist and what is not, right? And the beauty of this book in part is that it divorces it from the individual person, and rather it's speaking specifically about the idea. You can be someone who has no intention to be racist and who believes in equality and fights inequity, but because you're conditioned in a world that is racist and in a country that is structured on anti-black racism, that you yourself can perpetuate those ideas. Do you think, though, but as I was reading, I was looking back through some of the press coverage from when the book came out and some of the reviews, and even positive ones. I think there's a Post review. To the end of it, one of the only kind of criticisms is that they argue essentially that they just can't accept this idea that someone who otherwise is so anti-racist could, you know, be a racist by the nature of having perpetuating anti-racist ideas. Like you just said, you kind of went out of your way not to define anyone or a person as racist or something being racist. How do you think do you think it would be better for us to have conversations in which we were not attempting to assign racist as an adjective for a person, but rather we're talking about the underlying ideas? I mean, how do you think those things communicate with each other? Because very often, the invocation of that word in any context is basically the end of the conversation as opposed to the beginning of a productive one.
Yeah, the irony is that we live in a world in which no one, of course, wants to be identified as racist, but a large percentage of us, you know, and I say us for a reason, you know, have expressed and possibly still express and think racist ideas. And so that creates this sort of conundrum, right? I think that it is important to define a racist idea, but I also think it's important to define a racist policy, which is different than a racist idea. And then I also do think it's important to define a racist. And I'm actually, working on a book now entitled How to Be an Anti-Racist, which of course distinguishes that person from a racist. But in defining a racist or even an anti-racist, one of the things that I recognize is that these are not fixed categories. So in other words, a person can be a racist in the morning when they're expressing a racist idea or sort of championing a policy that discriminates a particular group. And then in the evening, they can be an anti-racist when they're expressing the equality of racial groups and championing an egalitarian policy. And I think that's indicative of humanity. Like, we're constantly changing, right? That's one of the beauties of humans. Like, we're extremely complex. We're hopefully changing, right, and growing, you know, and evolving and challenging ourselves. And so I think if we do define a racist, it should not be a fixed category. But then that creates problems for journalists, right? Because if somebody says a bunch of racist and anti-racist things in a speech, right,
how do you identify the person, right, in an article? But I'm not personally, you know, as a scholar, I don't think it's important for me to think about the practicality of these types of things as much as the reality of them, if that makes sense.
No, I think it makes a lot of sense. You write, and you've talked about how you began this book in part after the names of people like Trayvon Martin were in the headlines, and how moved and personally you felt about these issues. I think you said you began it with Trayvon Martin and ended it towards Sandra Bland as you were wrapping up your research and your work. In what ways do you think that the ideas that you chronicle historically showed up during the conversations we were having around Black Lives of these last few years? As people were arguing, and you've answered this already a little bit with the kind of All Lives Matter and Black Lives Matter and Blue Lives Matter, to what extent are we, whether it be through Trayvon Martin or Ferguson or Baltimore or Sandra Bland, continuing to have the same conversation? I just think that's an interesting kind of point to delve into a little further.
I think we're still engaged in those conversations, and I think the sort of origins or the flashpoint of these conversations is probably what I consider to be the most dangerous racist idea. And that is this idea that Black neighborhoods are the most dangerous and Black people are the most dangerous. Of course, that idea is based on what people consider to be statistics, that Black neighborhoods have more violent crime than, let's say, white neighborhoods, that Black neighborhoods have more crime in general than white neighborhoods. And, you know, as I sort of show and stand from the beginning, like, this is based on a series of misleading statistics. Mm-hmm. And first and foremost, the concept that Black neighborhoods have more crime, and if a police officer who was on the Blue Lives Matter side was in this room, he'd say, yeah, they have more crime because more people are arrested and incarcerated from those neighborhoods. So what that means then is a neighborhood that arrest rates are actually indicative of actual crime rates. So everyone in this room, every time we commit a crime, we're arrested. That's the way largely the policing and criminal justice community determines crime levels, right, in a particular community. Those who have the most arrests, those who have the most levels of incarceration. But we all know that people commit crimes and are not arrested, particularly when there are no cops around, because the cops don't think crime is in that area, right? Because those areas are rich and white, right? And so for us as a nation to think that actual crime levels are reflected in arrest rates, I mean, and for us to build our own criminal justice system on that false idea, I mean, it's just crazy. But not only do we build it on that idea, of course, the notion of more violent crime, right? Mm-hmm. And what we don't know, and I don't think even Black people are willing to step back and look at this, is that not all Black neighborhoods have the same levels of violent crime. And so if Black people really think about it, okay, which Black neighborhoods have higher levels of violent crime than other Black neighborhoods? They'd be like, you know what? The poorest Black neighborhoods. And then I would tell you that actually statistics show that across racial groups, there's correlation between unemployment levels and violent crime levels. And so what that means for me is, instead of us imagining these and calling these neighborhoods dangerous Black neighborhoods with dangerous people who are dangerous around cops and that's why they get shot so much, why don't we identify them as dangerous unemployed neighborhoods? Right? Wouldn't that change the policy conversation? Right? It wouldn't be about civilizing, developing, and finding fathers, right, for these people. Right? It would be about giving these people what?
We're having a conversation roughly 2 weeks after the events in Charlottesville, not too far from here at all, which for even folks who have not read your book forced a lot of people to grapple with the idea of dangerous, historic, racist ideas. As you watched, it's a similar question to the one I just asked, but as you watched and watch what is playing out between what is an emboldened and increasingly public expression of in no way veiled racist ideas, excited and proud racist ideas, clashing with the risen anti-racist movement that has been in the streets for these years. As you watch that coverage and watch these events, where do you see these current events intersecting with our history of racist ideas in the United States of America?
Sure. So I believed for a long time, and I think those who study African American history have largely been taught, and I say largely, though certainly not all sort of scholars of African American history, and I think society has largely been taught that when we understand our racial history, we're looking at a history of steady and continuous racial progress. Anybody heard about that concept? That we're marching along, right? You know, that things are better now.
Arc of the universe, right?
Yes. That things are better now than they were before. When something bad happens, we hear the same old, well, yeah, you know, we sometimes take a step back. So we have to take two steps forward, and then we talk about this step forward and step back sort of concept. But what we see is that we think that there's this singular historical force of racial progress that sometimes steps back but is continuously marching forward. And this is what Obama largely sort of hung his political brand on, right? That he was to a certain extent the embodiment, you know, of this march of racial progress. But what I sort of show and stand from the beginning is that we've actually had a dual history, that we have had racial progress, and I think Obama is a personification of that racial progress, but we've had a simultaneous progression of racism or racist progress. And I think Trump is the personification of racist progress. And I think typically racist progress has followed racial progress. That's essentially been the history, right? When black people have risen up, have broken through barriers, right? Those who erected those barriers did not go home to their sunny estates in Florida or even New Jersey or to their Trump Tower, right? That was supposed to be funny. No, because they're like, you know, it's just serious. That's actually what's happening. No, you know, they didn't basically go home, right? They erected new and ever more sophisticated discriminatory policies, and then created ever more sophisticated racist ideas to justify those policies.
Well, and that's actually leading me right up to what I was about to ask. In a second, I'm going to open it up to questions, and so if you start getting prepared, feel free. What we're going to ask everyone to do is, when you do have your question, we're going to come up to the microphone over here, because we are recording, and so we want to make sure we get all the questions. But that sets me up perfectly for what I wanted to ask, right? One of the other things that I thought was a remarkable finding of your research was the idea that hatred and racialized bigotry was actually secondary. That very often we think that, well, white people hate black people, and so therefore they discriminate against black people, right? Or that white people think black people are inferior, and so therefore they discriminate against them. But rather, what you found consistently was that first what would come would be the discriminatory policy, that people were looking for a way to advance their own self-interest by stepping on someone else. And then once they had done that, they now needed to justify the discrimination. And that was where these racist ideas came in. You're going to paraphrase that much better than I did. But I just thought that was also just remarkably insightful. It really challenged the way we think about this very often, right? Because it raises this question of which do we solve first? Do we solve the discriminatory process or policy, or do we go try to win the hearts and minds of people and make them less prejudiced, and then they will fix the system, right? And I think that you raise, like I said, your findings raise a real question about which makes the most sense.
Yes, and I think in writing Stamped from the beginning, I decided to distinguish between the producers of racist ideas, so the people who were writing the books, the people who were making the speeches, the people who were creating the films, and the consumers of racist ideas, right? The people who were reading the books, the people who were watching the films, you know? And I wanted to study the producers of racist ideas. So this book is about the producers. And I simply wanted to ask the question over and over again, why were they producing these ideas at that time? Like, and so in order to do that, I had to understand and even show. I mean, really, this book is largely a history of the United States, because I had to show it's a history of the United States, then a mini biography of all of these producers, right? Because you had to show their own personal interests and then the larger historical forces that they were operating in. And so once I distinguished between the producers and the consumers, and then started asking the question, why? Right, I saw over and over again these people producing these ideas to substantiate or justify or normalize discriminatory policies. That essentially discriminatory policies were creating racial inequality. And when you have an inequality between any two groups, and in this case racial groups, there's only two causes. Either it's being caused because the people are inferior, or it's being caused by some sort of discriminatory policy. And so they wanted you and I to not think that that inequality is caused by a discriminatory policy because it was benefiting them. And if we thought that it was being caused by a discriminatory policy, we would resist that policy, right? And so what fundamentally I found, I didn't, you know, again, this is through researching, the fundamental purpose or function of racist ideas historically has been to suppress resistance to racial discrimination. Because it allows us, when we look out at racial inequality, we're like, okay, that's because all these black people, there's something wrong with them. As opposed to looking for the discriminatory policies that created them. And we can understand this very simply with slavery. You know, I'm enslaving people because I want to make money. Abolitionists are resisting me, so I'm going to convince Americans that these people should be enslaved because they're black. And then people start believing those ideas that these people are so barbaric that they need to be enslaved, or they're so childlike that they need to be enslaved. See the difference between the segregationist and the assimilationist idea. And so then people believe that, become hateful and ignorant, and then act on it. Right. And then once you know, racist ideas become almost like a drug. Like once you hear them and become hooked, like you need more in order to sustain the way you see the world. Right. And so then they keep providing them. Right. And then they have you hooked. And I was hooked for a long time, and I was trying to relieve other people from being hooked.
So we'll go ahead and open it up for a question.
Yes. Thank you. Could you please address the role of religion in the creation and perpetuation of racist ideas?
Sure. So thank you so much for the question. I actually, the first section with Cotton Mather is largely on the way in which religion was very important in really the creation of racist ideas, in which racist ideas I show really were created by the Portuguese to justify their pioneering slave trading of African people. And they specifically had to justify their ideas before the Pope. And the way they went about doing that was saying, you know what? We're enslaving these people to civilize them. They're barbarians. So we're just gonna bring them back to Portugal and civilize them, right? And that's precisely the main purpose of, yeah, they're going to work a little, but we're primarily, you know, going to civilize them, right? And then, of course, there were other debates involved. So another major sort of the original theory for segregationist ideas was the curse of Ham, that black people are permanently inferior and worthy of enslavement as the cursed descendants of Ham. And that's the origins of blackness, right? Through this curse of Ham. While assimilationists were like, no, that's not how black people came about. Assimilationists at the time, and I say at the time of 1415, 16, and 1700s, were like, no, the origin of blackness is the hot sun of Africa.
Climate theory, right?
It's climate theory. So essentially, these original assimilationists were like, okay, we're all created equal. We were all created in the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden is in, anybody want to take a guess? Europe. So Adam and Eve were white. For some reason, their descendants, for some crazy reason, started migrating to the south, landed in Africa, and were blackened by the sun. And that's when they became ugly and barbaric. But climate theorists were like, we have a way to solve the race problem. Let's just bring them back up to Europe and their black skins will become white again. That was climate theory. So they were sort of, so you see both groups were using, of course, Christianity in particular to justify their ideas. Yes.
Hi. All right now. Tell it like it is. Thank you for your work. I want to ask you about the title. Is it your title or how did that come about, stamped from the beginning? Because the title intrigued me when I saw it, you know, and I started looking through the book and bought it because of the title. And I expected something a bit different.
Well, thank you for that question. So we're, of course, across the nation involved in a debate about Confederate monuments, right? Mm-hmm. And a particular group of people are making the case the Confederacy was not about racism. Confederate leaders were not racist. Well, actually, Jefferson Davis, on April 12th, 1860, not far from here, at the U.S. Capitol, he was a Mississippi senator, opposed a bill that would have provided education, mm-hmm. funding to educate black mm-hmm. people in Washington, D.C. And he went on to say this government was made for white men by white men. Everybody here, white men, not white women. He should have added rich white men, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then he would go on to say that the inequality between the white and black races was stamped from the beginning. Mm-hmm. This is on the floor of the U.S. Senate. Mm-hmm. And of course, a year later, he would become the president of the Confederacy.
Mm-hmm. And you see parallels in what you write about and talk about with the period of Reconstruction, and particularly what's happening with those statues. And thank you for mentioning E. Franklin Frazier. I am a student of E. Franklin Frazier's.
Oh, okay.
Yes. He was my professor at Howard University, and he was chair of the sociology department. But I worry about history repeating itself. So what is the way forward? Is it talking about ideas as opposed to what is wrong with white people? You know, because nobody talks about that. Yeah, except, you know, or the whole thing about us looking barbaric, us smelling barbaric, all of the negative images and stereotypes around people of color. And Du Bois said that color consciousness was going to be a major issue, you know, in the 20th century.
Yeah, and I think the way forward is for us to realize very simply that there's nothing wrong with people. There's mm-hmm. nothing wrong with groups of people. Mm-hmm. And if there's inequality, we need to focus on the policies that create that inequality. And the way we change policy is by getting into positions of power or challenging power to change those policies.
Okay.
Oh, excellent. We got another microphone over here as well. Sorry about that.
I want to commend your approach in this book. What you're doing is American intellectual history. You're looking at the history of thinkers. That's a rich area that there's a lot more to be mined there, I'm sure. Yeah. I want to ask about assimilation. It seems to me that at some point assimilation, there's a gray area where assimilation becomes difficult to identify. And I'd like you to try to refine that a little bit.
Okay.
Gentiles are underrepresented on Wall Street. White males are underrepresented in the NBA. Does the assimilation shift into something else where other factors come into play?
So I think the over and underrepresented representation of a particular groups, and really this doesn't have to as much do with assimilationist or even anti-racist ideas as much as, okay, what are the policies in our society that's creating a situation in which white men are underrepresented and black men are overrepresented in the NBA, and the same thing with Wall Street. And I think for us to step back and see, okay, what do black men have more opportunities in basketball than we do, let's say, in my field of academia? I would say yes. Are they looked at? Are they encouraged more? And so I think for us to step back and sort of look at the policies that are leading to these different types of inequalities, whether no matter sort of what group is on the lower end of the inequality.
Thank you. I must always start out by saying I'm not from the United States. I'm from the Caribbean, a small Dutch-French island.
What's the name of it?
St. Martin.
Okay.
I was born in Aruba, grew up in St. Martin, went to the Netherlands to study. It's colonialism, you know.
Yes.
But a few questions, because I'm somewhat, I haven't read your book yet, but I'm going to read it. But I'm troubled by certain things here, and I think we should talk about it.
Oh, let's please.
Did you, the question is going to be, well, the first question is the definition of racism, and therefore the difficulty of really getting it under control as it slips and slides and adapts itself and changes itself. You talk about that a little bit, but it's a very dangerous thing that we're facing now. The second issue is about the history of racism.
So I think one of the difficulties, as you know, Wesley, in writing about race, or even more specifically racism, is that there's been so much written, right, about it, and so much theory. That have been sort of constructed, particularly to define prejudice or even now bias. And also, since race is so personal to all of us, we also pick and choose ideas that reflect or embrace our own personhood, our own identity. And so that creates a situation in which it's very difficult for people to engage in a conversation about race with an open mind, with a willingness to potentially critique yourself. And I don't think I could have produced Stamp from the beginning without critiquing myself. And so one thing I'll say very quickly about his point about the origins of racism. So you can't have racism if race doesn't exist, right? And so there was certainly, in the pre-modern world, there was all sorts of ethnocentrism, economic exploitation, sexism, but race, Black Africa, white Europe, right? As two examples, that's a modern creation. And so with that being a modern creation, that was the concept of race and racism actually merged simultaneously, right? Because the whole nation was to create, okay, how were the Portuguese going to justify the enslavement of all of these different looking peoples and different ethnic groups? It was to racialize them as one inferior people. And so I write about the way that the creation of race itself was important to the transatlantic slave trade, because as we know, many different ethnic groups were enslaved. Yes.
Yes. You raise an interesting point regarding ideological nuances and race. For example, when you hear people talk about their responses to the Charlottesville incident, you know, you hear people say, well, racism is abhorrent. It's something that we do not support. But by the same token, people are silent when it comes to voter suppression, particularly in the South, for example. Now you have this, now it becomes part of public policy. For example, when you have somebody in the White House, such as Chris Kobach, who has basically been assigned to facilitate voter suppression at this moment. So I wanted to get your thoughts on that issue.
Well, thank you for that. And I think one of the reasons why I sort of wanted to craft and show this whole history of assimilationist ideas as racist ideas is because we have largely only been angry. We only get riled up in response to segregationist ideas and segregationist acts, which typically is slavery, mass incarceration, genocide of Black people, right? We don't get as upset, we're not as outraged at these more insidious forms of discrimination and the ideas that justify them. So after the election, right, an election that was largely won, I would argue, due to the suppression of Black voters and other types of voters, instead of us focusing on that, many of us, and I'm sure I did it too, started blaming particular groups of people, right? Because of course we're taught to say that the people are the problem. You know what? Why didn't black people come out to vote for Hillary like they did Barack? You know, why did all those white women vote for Trump? Why did 30% of Latinos vote for Trump? All of the, why did millennials stick with Bernie and stay hope? Like, why, you know, again, we focused on, right, the people, which is precisely what bigotry compels us to do, assimilationist bigotry, as opposed to thinking about, okay, what were the policies, what were the suppression techniques that actually led to his victory? I can't even say his name, sorry.
I'll go back over here.
I'd like to thank you for your academic research and work. I think it's noteworthy to learn about history. But I want to focus on the two elephants in the room, white supremacy and white privilege. I believe you're familiar with Dr. Leonard Jeffries.
Oh, yeah.
He said, we are living with the illusion of inclusion. Andrew Hacker, his book, Two Nations, One Black, One White, Hostile, Unequal, and Separate. And recently, Chris Hedges wrote a book, A Colony in a Nation. I think the issues that the Africans and the Europeans really can't mix, and we are living with the illusion, and I worry that the young people in this room, years from now, are going to be coming to these events fighting the same problem. So if we begin to tell African Americans that these two races are separate, they really cannot mix. I have an article here from the Wall Street Journal, August 2017. Whiter towns secede from districts in some states. Subsequent to that, white economic privilege is alive and well. And segregation in New York schools. New York City has one of the most deeply segregated school systems in the nation, in spite of everything that's being done. And it seems to me, so long as African Americans continue with that illusion that somehow whites and Africans can live, Europeans and Africans can live together, I don't think it's going to work. It's not because we don't want it to work, but I don't think
what
Europeans...
Do you, when you say work, what are you referring to?
The assimilation. There's no hard evidence to support it. So if we go down to Washington, D.C. at noon, we will see Africans and Europeans walking together and talking together. But that's not assimilation, because at the end of the day, they go to their separate homes and they really don't mix.
So there's, I'm not really sure what you mean when you say mix, because I'm not sure if you're speaking from a biological standpoint. And actually, for a long time, segregationists made the case that that mulattoes should be called as such because they're mules, right? Because the races can't mix, right? But I'm not sure whether you're talking about it from a cultural standpoint or a social standpoint.
No, you're not focusing on what I'm doing.
Is what you're asking or what you're saying essentially, are you premising that it is in fact... that we are incapable, that these groups are incapable of together creating an equitable society.
Yes.
Right.
And I'm saying Europeans.
Okay.
Don't have
Can
a
I respond
with that,
to that? Okay.
But I'm saying Africans do.
So. Okay. So, I think that if we one of the things that I think we do with race. And I think we do this with racist ideas, is we take these individual examples and generalize them. And so we take examples in which racial groups are in battle and say, this demonstrates that these two racial groups can't get along. Which of course reinforces our original theory that what? These people can't get along. But there are examples in which people are able to live together. But we don't generalize those. Just like when we sort of come across a young black male who's violent, we say, black males are violent. right? And we forget all of those times in which we passed by all of those black males who were not what? Violent, right? And so I think one of the things we have to be willing to do is not generalize, not use individual examples to generalize. And I think that's what the brother was doing. And so I don't necessarily agree based on his anecdotal evidence, because I can bring anecdotal evidence like this room where I think people can get along. Now, one thing I will say in agreement with him is that I don't think African Americans should be seeking to assimilate into whiteness. I don't think African Americans should view whiteness as superior. You know what? White schools are better. I have to send my kids there. White neighborhoods are better. I have to live there. White churches are better. I have to worship there. You know, white beauticians are better. I have to get my hair there. White businesses are better. I don't think African Americans should be engaged in that type of practice. Because those ideas that African Americans have, I would argue, are assimilationist ideas, are the real black on black crime.
We have time for two more.
What do you think is the fate of racism under Donald John Trump?
So I think the fate of racism is its resurgence, its progression. And I think we're seeing this, as we mentioned earlier, with voting, in which he is leading a group of people around the world, around the country, really the world too, right? In figuring new ways and more, ever more sophisticated ways to suppress and even prevent people from voting. He has imagined, or his, what do we call him, Jeff Sessions, has imagined that, you know, we're in a post-racial society and people of color are no longer being discriminated against, and the only people who are being discriminated against are white people, and so therefore I have to use the Civil Rights Division to basically challenge these colleges and other bodies that are discriminating against white people, which, by the way, is the same perspective of the white supremacists who marched in Charlottesville. Their idea is that white people are undergoing a genocide, and that genocide is the result of egalitarian policies. That genocide is the result of immigration policies. That genocide is the result of anti-racism or Black Lives Matter, right? It's the same position. But of course, there's the distancing politically, but the connection ideologically. And so, in a short answer, the progression of racism.
Thank you.
So I'm going to cheat a little bit, if you bear with me, if you guys could both ask your questions, okay. And then I'll have him answer both of them.
Okay, because I'm cheating,
I'm going to do my wrap-up now, so that as soon as he's done, we can applaud and get everyone, because everyone's going to buy the book, get everyone's book signed. And so again, thank you all. Thank you all for being out here tonight. Thank you for the great conversation, for the questions. Like I said, make sure to grab this book. It's not quite a beach read, but you got a long Labor Day weekend coming up, so there'll be time to read it. Thank you guys again for coming out, and we'll go ahead and ask both questions.
I would like to ask Dr. Kendi if he could talk a little bit about his vision for the anti-racist center that he's is the founding director of. I'm very interested in that.
Okay, my question was referring to, somebody made a statement earlier about basketball and how black men have, a privilege when it comes to that. And to me, that seemed like a white privilege kind of statement, because the assumption that African Americans have to use sports and entertainment as a way to get out of their situation is a racist idea in the first place, So when you say that a black man, he can only dribble, so that's why all black men play basketball all day, that is a racist assumption. So I think at the end, I guess it was kind of like, oh, well, yeah, they have the privilege, they get more opportunity to do that, but it's not really like they get more opportunity, it's more so that's the only opportunity that's given to them. So I don't know if that's what you were saying or what the person was trying to say, but if we could just kind of clear that up a bit.
So I'll answer that question or statement first, and then I'll talk about the center. I think the best way to restate, I think what I've said multiple times, is when we look at inequality, either it's because of the people or the policies. And even when Black people are overrepresented in prisons or on basketball courts or in the military and other places, you know, it's not because, you know, Black people are by nature better athletes, right, or Black people are by nature better, or actually people would say that Black people are inferior criminals, which is why they're in prison. But if we see the racial groups as equal, right, then we know it's not because Black people sort of have this speed or jump gene and white men can't jump, right? But that's what we're continuously taught, right? When we turn on, HBO. I'm not like trying to get on HBO. I should, right? But I'm no Confederate, right? So one thing I want to say very quickly about this issue of athletics, because I think it's something that I think I buried in the book, and it's not something that I've spoken about as much, and that is when we think about the racial hierarchy, the Black-white racial hierarchy, we typically think of whites at the top and Blacks below. There are two sort of steps on the racial hierarchy ladder. But from the beginning of racist ideas, there's actually been three steps. And below, Black people have been animals. And so Black people have not only been rendered inferior to white people, they have been rendered like animals. And the way animals are portrayed by these intellectuals is as the most physically superior beings on earth. And so that's how people can simultaneously render Black people intellectually inferior, because the most intellectually superior beings on earth, according to these theorists, are white people, but simultaneously physically superior, which is why they're better athletes, supposedly, better in bed, better dancers, anything that has to do with their physicality, because they're like animals, right? And so when we, I say we in terms of African Americans, when we embrace this as part of our identity, right, that Black people are great dancers, or Black people are great by nature, like better in all of these physical things, we don't understand that they were actually comparing ourselves to animals. Finally, in terms of the center, I don't know how I'm going to segue from that to that. But as I think everybody could sense through our conversation, through writing STEM from the beginning, I came to realize that if I really wanted to eliminate ignorance and hate in this country, I had to focus on, and we had to focus on, eliminating racist ideas. And in order for us to eliminate racist ideas, we had to focus on their cradle, which are racist policies. And that's the fundamental sort of thesis of the text, that racist policies are driving racist ideas, that the focus of racial justice activists should not be on changing people's minds, because I can change somebody's mind, you know, a consumer, but then they're going to go out and consume more ideas that were produced by people who are trying to defend policies, right? So if we eliminate the policies, then if we change the policies, if we imagine more egalitarian policies, then we can, of course, eliminate the ideas and the ignorance and hate. And so ultimately, what I'm hoping to do with this center is to create a space, of course, going to need quite a bit of funding, where we bring together groups of scholars and students at AU and around the country and around the world to study inequality, to figure out the discriminatory policies behind those inequalities, and to recommend and suggest and work with policymakers and lawmakers more egalitarian policies that will then reduce the inequality, right, and then reduce the ideas that are substantiating and defending that inequality, right? And so it's going to be organized around six areas right now, but people are advocating for a few more. Those six areas are education, economics, environment, health, criminal justice, and politics. And so groups of scholars and students will engage in national and international projects studying inequality and discrimination in those six areas.
How about one more round of applause?
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.